Welcome to another edition of the Baseball America Prospect Handbook Podcast. J.J. Cooper joined today by Ben Badler. We're going to talk prospects. Hey, what you expect on the Prospect Handbook Podcast. We're going to talk who's the number one prospect left in the minor leagues, but also a guy who's no longer a prospect, but we're kind of interested in Blue Jays second baseman Devin Travis, who's off to a pretty sensational start. Ben Badler has been kind of leading the Devin Travis fan club for a long time, but I don't even think Ben saw this. So we're going to talk about Devin a little bit as well. But we do want to start today with the question that is an obvious question. Chris Bryant's up to the big leagues. He was our number one prospect coming into the season. Addison Russell, who was our number three prospect coming into the season on the BA Top 100 prospects list, is also up in the big leagues for the Cubs. And that leads to the question, so who's the number one prospect left in the minor leagues? The obvious candidates you have at the top of the list, number two prospect coming into the season, Byron Buxton, number four prospect coming into the season, Carlos Correa, and number five prospect coming into the season, Corey Seager, all of whom are having very solid starts to their 2015 seasons, especially Correa and Seager. Seager's already earned a promotion to AAA Oklahoma City. Didn't take him but less than a month to earn the promotion to AAA. Correa is among minor league leaders in many, many, many categories. He leads the Texas League in almost everything right now. And Byron Buxton was off to a slow start, a little rust as he comes back from the concussion he suffered at the end of last year. But he's kind of shaken that rust off. In the last 5 days, he has four triples and a homer. He's gotten his numbers up to kind of where you would expect, around 280, 350, 500 plus slugging percentage. So not bad for a 21-year-old center fielder in AA Southern League as well. So Ben, before we come back to me and kind of what I found from surveying pro scouting people and all, I'll ask you, who to you is the number one prospect in the minors right now?
Yeah, I mean, these guys are both, like you said, off to tremendous starts, and Seager is too, obviously, but you know, we're talking about two potential cornerstone franchise type players who, you know, I could see both of them winning MVP awards one day. But to me, the separation here is Byron Buxton's defense, because I see them both as premium hitters, guys who could hit, you know, whether you're going to put them at the top of the lineup or in the middle of the lineup. These guys are going to be two of the best hitters in baseball. They can hit. They control the strike zone. They have really good plate coverage, and they both have I think they're both going to have plus or better power, and that's going to play in games. They're both going to get on base at a high clip. I think that to me, the difference is Byron Buxton's defense puts him ahead, because you're talking about a guy who has the potential, you know, top of the line speed and outstanding instincts in the outfield, throws well too. All the ingredients are there for him to be a gold glove caliber defender in center field. Carlos Correa, you know, I think there were some questions about whether he's going to stay at shortstop, maybe get too big, move over to third base. For me, he's a shortstop. I don't see any reason why he can't play shortstop, but I don't see him as an above average defensive shortstop. I see him as somebody who can play the position and be solid defensively at shortstop, but not somebody who's going to be above average or really elite defensively at the position the way that Byron Buxton, it's not even really has the potential to be. It's almost like he already is right now with the speed and the instincts that he has. Obviously, he still has some, he's not ready right now offensively, but the defense is ready right now, and it's premium top of the scale defense.
I've always kind of been I've been a Buxton guy for a long time. Still kind of think back to probably one of my favorite minor league trips I've ever done was seeing Buxton for 4 days against Kane County and Carlos Correa's Quad Cities team back 2 years ago. And I can't believe I'm saying that, but I right now I was kind of surprised. I sent out to a number of upper level front office people around baseball, none of them with the Dodgers, Astros, or Twins, because hey, they've got a dog in this fight. Just kind of asked the question, hey, who would you say is the best prospect left in the minors now? And I was a little surprised how, again, take it for what it was. It was seven. I got seven responses that actually gave a vote, but of those seven, five of the seven chose Carlos Correa. And what jumped out is that I think I follow all the logic of what you're saying. And I think the case for why people may say Correa, I think I wrote this in SBA, it's up at baseballamerica.com right now. There may be a little bit of recency bias in that. Carlos Correa is off to a great start. But I think more than that, it really comes down to, okay, where do you value, let's say that Correa is a solid average shortstop versus an exceptional center fielder. That's an interesting debate of which is, you know, which provides more value there. And I think really the other question becomes, do you think that Correa may end up having, at this point, I probably would say, I think there's a pretty good chance that Correa ends up with more power than Buxton. And I think Buxton could end up with, as you said, we're talking about, this is like saying, you know, the old sabermetrics versus scouts argument, beer tacos. Yes, you know, everyone kind of said with this, do you know, if you'll give our team Corey Seager, Carlos Correa, or Byron Buxton, we'd be happy. But it really comes down to Buxton is a more explosive player. Buxton is a top of the scale speed guy with that gold glove caliber center field defense, should hit for average and hits for some power. And there's still some question about how much power is going to be in there. Is it going to be 10 home run power? Is it going to be 15 home run power? Is it going to be 20 home run power? Correa is a guy who the speed, he's 11 for 11 right now on steals, which I think you tweeted out last night, which is a stunning stat. But that doesn't mean he's a burner in any way, shape, or form. He's kept every bit of his speed that he's had, that he had when he was drafted. And some, you know, who I've talked to say he's a little faster now. And he's done that while he's also, if you look at him now compared to what he was when he was drafted, upper body, he's got a lot more strength there. His chest is that of a grown man now, whereas when he was drafted, he was a very tall framed but a little bit slender guy who's really kind of worked to get stronger and stronger. But he's kept the speed, which is important because it's not like he has plus speed, but he's kept enough speed where, as you said, there's a lot less debate now whether he's going to stick at shortstop. And so it really seems like a lot of it comes down to if you give a number of teams an option of, you know, can I have a shortstop who's a middle of the order hitter who could hit for average and power versus a gold glove type center fielder who can hit for as much, if not a little bit more average and maybe a little less power, that maybe they take the shortstop out of that. And the funny guy who, you know, the funny thing here is this is not a slight to Corey Seager, who I know that you're a giant Corey Seager fan. So am I. Both of us think that he's going to be a really, really good big leaguer before long. Why do you think Seager, I guess, kind of may end up a third in this discussion, Ben?
Yeah, I just think Correa has more first step quickness. They're both gigantic human beings. They're, big bodied shortstops. I just don't see, you know, Correa, they're both smart players. I mean, like we were talking about, Correa's stolen bases are really more, he runs well. He's not a plus runner. That's more of a testament to his high baseball IQ and in all phases of the game.
Down the line, he's 4.3 to 4.35 generally. I mean, that's a right-handed hitter, that's average. That's not better than that.
Yeah, but it's, look, if there's guys who are faster in the 60, there are guys who are 80 runners who can't steal bases. And it's, you know, what's more valuable? I'll take the guy who can, who knows how to apply the speed to the game. Now, it makes a difference if you're, you know, a center fielder and you have to run around and track down balls. But, it helps your range. It's better to be an 80 runner than a 50 runner. But, you know, if you know how to pick your spots, you know how to read pitchers. You know, there's a lot of guys who rack up a lot of stolen bases who are just average runners in the big leagues. You know, for me, the difference is I just see Seager as more of a third baseman, which is fine. He's going to hit way, way, way above what the average third baseman is going to hit. And he's got all the tools to be an above average defender at third baseman. Yeah. To me, he's a number three prospect who's still in the minor leagues, which is not a slight to him. I just see a little bit more, premium value in the positional value that Correa and that Buxton bring to the table.
I do think with Seager, I wouldn't be stunned if he came up as a shortstop. I don't think he's going to stay there long term. And that kind of look at that from the standpoint of the best way I can put it is if Wilmer Flores is playing shortstop in the big leagues on a regular basis, Corey Seager can play shortstop in the big leagues on a regular basis. What Seager lacks is that kind of that range. He's not a rangy guy, but he can play deep because he has a really good arm. And if you ask me what Seager's best defensive attribute is, he has it's an outstanding ability to get rid of the ball very quickly. Watching a game this year, recently when he was still in the Texas League, and there was a ball where he had to come in on it, and he didn't show great range to get there. But the thing that really did stand out is when that ball hit his glove, his transfer and then the ball was out of his hand in a blur. You know, we talk a lot about infield actions. That's one aspect of infield actions. His release is really quick, which allows him to get to more balls than you would expect because he has to work a little harder to get there. And again, there's some balls he's just not going to get to. Like you, I think he's a third baseman. He's going to be a very good third baseman down the road. The one advantage I will say for him, and I would put him number three right now as well, but the one advantage he has is you got to love the lefty bat. I do think there is some advantage for that as far as hitting for average in the big leagues just because of platoon advantages and all. But again, with all these guys, you are talking about truly, really exceptional prospects. You know, three of the best prospects in the game, three of the best prospects been around in a while. There wasn't really a pitcher who worked into that discussion, kind of asked people about it. And really the only guys who were coming up kind of in that discussion were Lucas Giolito and Julio Urias. And I would say that both of those guys are probably behind the hitters because we're talking about hitters who are 20, 21 years old in double and triple A. There's a lot to be said for that. There's a lot more certainty with that in many ways. But before we move on, I did just want to ask you about Julio Urias. He's a fascinating guy to me because there just really aren't analogs to him. You're talking about an 18-year-old who's really, in many ways, too advanced for the Texas League. Can you think of anything you ever seen like that? What jumps out to you when you think and what you see Julio Urias?
Yeah, like you said, just unprecedented. There's no, you try to look for, okay, like we can say Carlos Correa, when is he going to be up? Well, you know, you can look at other guys who've been in his situation before. I mean, Manny Machado was really in a similar situation with the Orioles a few years back, and the Orioles brought him up and, he helped them down the stretch when they brought him up that year, and I think it was in August. So, you know, I could see something if the Astros are contending and still contending, which, hey, that's unbelievable surprise to me.
But at this point, they've built up enough of a lead that it's hard for them to imagine them not at least contending for.
Yeah, those wins are in the bank, whereas, you know, the Twins, you know, I don't see them being competitive at all the rest of the year, and I don't see any reason to start Byron Buxton's service clock, whereas, yeah, like you said, you don't want to start with Urias. You don't want to there's so many things that you want to manage his innings. He's still 18 years old. You want to be cautious with him, and you look at Andrew Friedman and how the Rays handled their pitching prospects in Tampa Bay. I'm not sure there was a more conservative organization when it came to developing pitchers and how they moved them along. But they had a lot of success doing it.
At the rate the Rays develop pitchers, the way they move them along, Julio Urias should be back in short season ball next year.
Yeah, but it's when you have somebody who is just so dominant. I mean,
advanced too.
Yeah, it's front of the rotation, number one starter type of stuff, and the pitchability that he has. I mean, he's born in 1996. The guys we're talking about who are going to be drafted this year out of high school were born in 1996. It's really
he would be the number one pick in the draft if he was available in this year's draft. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's so I think he has the talent to be up this year at some point if the Dodgers want to bring him up. Would I bring him up right now? No. But there's no need to bring him up right now. But if they wanted to bring him up in the second half of the season, down the stretch, yeah, I mean, it sounds pretty wild for a guy who's never thrown more than 90 innings in a season and who's still 18 years old. You want to be careful with him, but at some point he's sort of force his way onto there. So he might be, by the end of the year, he might be one of their five best starting pitchers in the organization.
No, I think that that's not crazy at all. I think that right now, I follow it for developmental reasons, but if they needed a spot start, if you're asking me, do I think that he would be capable of doing it? I think he would be. I it's not like the only guy I can think of, one's right-handed, one's left-handed. They're very different, but who at that age is you go back to Felix Hernandez, but Felix was really a year older than Urias, kind of at the same stage of development as far as level he was at and all. And the difference was is that Hernandez was doing it at the time the way you would expect a teenager to do it, which was he had really kind of blow you away stuff. Urias has blow you away stuff at his best, but he is really comfortable just cruising where you're looking for a fastball, he's giving you a changeup. You're looking for the changeup, he's dropping a breaking ball on you. He's pitching at, you know, and he's doing that with a fastball that will touch 95 on a pretty regular basis. It's pretty fun to watch. On Correa, I've said it. I would be surprised if Carlos Correa is not up at some point this year, barring injury with the Astros, because Jed Lowry's not going to be healthy until after the All-Star break, it looks like. And it's fine to, you know, to basically turn to Marwin Gonzalez right now and Jonathan VR, but the reality of it is that Carlos Correa is better than those guys right now. Does that mean he's ready? That may not be entirely true, but he's better than those guys. I remember a scout last year when he was coming out of low A in spring training, looking at him and going, the rough thing about it is you look at him out there and he's about the best player on the team right now. And that was a year plus ago. Yes, he's doesn't have much double A time, but as you mentioned, he's got more minor league plate appearances right now than Manny Machado did when Machado went up. And Machado was doing that, and he was getting called up to play third base, a position he had essentially learned about a day before that. Carlos Correa would be called up to play shortstop. Carlos Correa has played shortstop for an awful long time. I expect that at some point this year, possibly before the Futures game, we will get to see Carlos Correa in the big leagues. I don't have any inside info. That's not, you know, someone passing along to me, but that's just talking to scouts who ask some questions, you think he could do it? And there's a lot of answers of, yeah, I think he probably could. And he's that kind of special kind of player.
Yeah, no, I could definitely see him up in the second half. On the other hand, you know, look, we've seen guys like, you know, Xander Bogaerts, who I think was, you know, just as talented as Correa was when he was in the minor leagues. And we've seen we've seen him struggle a lot in, you know, a year plus.
Mike Trout, a similar call up to what we'd be talking about with Correa, it wasn't very good. But you turn around the next year and he's Mike Trout. Another example, you know, Trout's one that jumps out. Look at, and it's a little younger than this, but look at what A-Rod did when he came up with the Mariners. Now, that was the strike year, which kind of, he didn't even get a chance to really get any momentum going. But he wasn't A-Rod in his first call-up, but you turn around and he was A-Rod the next year. So, again, you're right. There's some risk to it, but if Jed Lowry was healthy, we wouldn't be talking about this. If it's between Marlon Gonzalez and Carlos Correa, that becomes a much more interesting debate.
Right. I don't think either of us are saying, if I understand, I'm not saying call him up now.
No,
I don't think the Astros or, you know, or the Dodgers with Urias or Seager, I don't think any of those guys should be up right now. But I think it's a very realistic possibility for talking about come, you know, after the All-Star break or maybe even around that time, you know, we could see any of these guys up in the majors.
Again, if you get to June 1st with Carlos Correa or June 15th and the Astros are still right there at the top of what's quite frankly a down AL West.
Very winnable division.
Very winnable division. And you look at it and Gonzalez and Villar, neither of them's really, you're really that comfortable with them at shortstop. And he then has, let's close to 200 at double A at bats under his belt. And he's hitting 350, 360 like he is right now. You have to seriously consider that. It'll be fun to watch. But that's going to be fun to watch. One thing that's already been fun to watch is watching Devin Travis with the Blue Jays so far. They went with the youth movement. A lot of that youth movement's back in AAA right now. Devin Travis is not going back to the minors anytime soon. Ben, you have always been a very big proponent of Devin Travis. He was in our top 100 2 years ago. With the injuries he had last season, he did drop out of the top 100. But again, I know you didn't see this. I don't think anyone saw this. I don't think Devin Travis saw this. But what is it about Devin Travis that really kind of jumped out to you over the years?
He always could hit. He had a really simple, easy swing. He doesn't have a big strike zone. I think people look at him, oh, well, he's only 5'9", and that, you know, people say, oh, that's, you know, that's, he gets knocked for that. Players who are short, I think, tend to be undervalued. It's legitimate to, you know, to worry about a player's size, especially if you're talking about a kid who's 18 years old and rookie ball. But, you know, when you're raking in Double A, it's less important, and it's almost an advantage in some ways, just because he has a smaller strike zone. He doesn't expand it much. He's got those short hitter arms. You know, we've seen him turn around 97, 98 mile an hour fastballs on the inside corner and launch them over the fence. I mean, what he's doing now is, it's not a fluke. I mean, no, he's not going to have a 980 OPS right now. That's,
he's not
going to
have a Miguel Cabrera triple crown type year OPS when the season's over.
No, that's obviously going to, you know, regress and come back down to earth. But the way he's doing it, it's not like he's just getting these, you know, bloop hits here and there, and he's just getting, you know, lucky on a lot of his balls in play. This guy has, you know, all the attributes to be able to hit. And, you know, as we've written before, you know, this guy is, you know, he's not big, but he puts a charge into the ball for a little guy. He's got a lot of strength in that really compact frame.
One thing you hopefully learn things as we do this. And one thing I've learned, and I think a lot of scouts have learned, is I am much, much, much less inclined to discount the short, especially the short second baseman, than I used to be. I remember talking to people about Jose Altuve and talking to scouts who I very much respect, who kind of discounted Altuve, and they just thought he was too small to ever be physical enough to really be anything more than a role player at the big league level. And that sure looks inaccurate now. Yeah, again, you don't want to throw Dustin Pedroia as the patron saint of this, and Dustin Pedroia was a guy who there were a lot of people thought he's too small to be, you know, to really be an impact type guy, especially if a guy who takes that big a swing. You know, that's just not going to work at the big league level. And Dustin Pedroia has that very rare hand eye that made it work. I've been burned on that before. I'm not going to be burned again. And that was really kind of with Travis, something where it's, if the knocks on him is that he's, if there's something else, okay, let's hear it. But if it's that he's too small, as you said, he's had an ability to drive the baseball. So you kind of got to throw that concern out a little bit. So
yeah, I think there's a few things that maybe worked against Travis. One, like we talked about, he's just not very big. You know, it's easy to write a player off who just doesn't look like, you know, I don't even want to say he doesn't look like a major leaguer, because look at the major leagues. Look at the guy who won the batting title last year in the American League. Yeah, it's, you know, the idea of a major league body is just sort of silly to me. Look at the major league body of the guy who just won the batting title. Look around. It's the bodies in the major league. It's not all guys who are 6'3" with chiseled frames. It's just not reality. There's this idea that everybody has to be like that, but it's just not reflective of reality. But look, Travis is not toolsy. There's nothing, you know, on the chart other than, you know, his bat, which is, I think, the most important tool that you would put a, you know, a 60 or a 70 on. It's a lot of average tools. And then he plays second base. And I think that there's just way too high of a mental penalty that gets applied to either to prospects who are second basemen in the minors or shortstop prospects who project to move to second base. It's not, you know, I think people say, oh, well, this guy's not a shortstop, or this guy's going to have to move off of shortstop and he's going to have to go to second base, as if like second base is, you know, first base or DH. It's not an easy position to play. Now, there's obviously risk if you can't play second base. you know, where do you go? Maybe you probably don't have a, you know, a big arm or a ton of speed, so maybe you go to left field.
There's risk. Second baseman who can't play second base end up in left field.
Right. So there's risk there, but Travis could always play second base. I mean, the Tigers experimented with him a little bit in center field, but that was more because we have Ian Kinsler there, and Ian Kinsler is not going to go anywhere. So let's try to get this guy's bat into the lineup somehow. So I think that works against him. The other things were, look, this guy was a 13th round draft pick, and wherever you get drafted, that tag seems to stick with you throughout your career in the minor leagues. And, you know, at the time you're drafted, I suppose it's indicative in some ways of how he was viewed within the industry at the time, but I just don't care where a player was drafted. I mean, within a couple of months, we can find out that, wow, you know, this guy was, or any player, their stock can change pretty significantly after they've been in pro ball, whether it's been a couple of months or certainly for a year or for 2 years. But then that tag seems to get stuck to a player for his whole career. And it can help guys who are first round picks and always have that tag attached to him, but it can work against guys who are late round draft picks, but who've really either improved their stock or have just shown that, look, this guy is much better than people originally thought. And then the last thing that I think works against Devin Travis and other comparable players to Travis, guys who there's nothing flashy, the tools are average, but the bat is a potential plus bat. If you're a pro scout, you go in and you see a guy for a three-game series, he's probably not going to do anything that makes you go, oh, wow, you know, this guy really caught my attention. You know, I saw Roman Quinn with the Phillies, who is an 80-runner, unbelievably explosive athlete. You see somebody like that for, I mean, even one game, he's going to catch your attention. And if he does well in a few games, yeah, you're probably going to turn him in pretty high. But if you see Devin Travis, somebody like that, or you know, a guy like Matt Carpenter when he was in the minor leagues, these are guys who I think you have to see a lot, see play in on a regular basis, day in, day out, to really appreciate the kind of ability that he has, the kind of plate coverage that he has, and the ability to hit that he has, and control the strike zone, and do all the things that he does at the plate that will project at the major league level. And projecting hitting is extremely challenging, but I think just the scouting, the general pro scouting process of going in and seeing these guys for, you know, a series at a time, and then moving on and seeing other affiliates, maybe checking back in, you know, one or two other times throughout the year, it's not conducive to being able to get the best possible read on a player like Travis, who isn't going to do anything that jumps out at you immediately.
You know, the teams that actually should have a little bit of heads up on that? Teams who have opposing teams in the same leagues as a guy like Devin Travis. You should get a better feel if you're playing him on a regular basis. That's where you kind of have to count on the managers, that your manager's reports are pretty good as well. And, hey, again, credit to the Blue Jays. They landed him in a trade.
And they are, you know, the Blue Jays have an Eastern League affiliate. I mean, it's, you know, sometimes, you know, managers do go in and write up players. I don't know how much.
And an FSL affiliate, too.
Yeah, so they
and a Midwest League affiliate.
So, yeah, so I'm sure they've seen him, you know, punish them plenty enough over the years. And some teams, you know, managers do, like we said, they go in and they write up the opposing players that they see. So, you know, some teams listen to it more. Some teams you know, don't treat those, you know, don't treat those opinions, you know, with a lot of those opinions don't influence much, but for certain organizations. But yeah, you're right. I think if you see a guy on a regular basis like that, it can certainly be an important part of the evaluation when it comes time to make a decision on a trade like that.
Well, again, we don't see him doing what he did here, but this first month of the season pretty much guarantees that he now has a regular job for probably most of the season at this point. Again, you know, you can't fall apart, but what do you see long-term? I will kind of wrap it up with, what do you think long-term Devin Travis ends up being as a big leaguer?
Yeah, I think the name we used in the report when he was the Tigers' number one prospect, which I believe was the same day they traded him to the Blue Jays, was Josh Harrison, just another guy who, you know, I don't think Travis is going to move around the field like Josh Harrison has with the Pirates, but, you know, just another guy who's not very big, but has, you know, is strong and can put a charge on the ball and has always been able to hit with a good idea of what he's doing at the plate, waits for a good pitch to hit, and controls the strike zone, has good bat control, somebody who's going to hit a lot for a little guy. And, you know, it's not above average raw power, but it's, you know, it might be, you know, it's playing as better than fringe average power right now. I think you're looking at a guy who could be, you know, 10 to 15 home runs, who's, you know, a potential 300 hitter with the, you know, the pretty good on base percentage. You put that with solid defense at a middle of the diamond position, you know, that's an above average player.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see kind of when we look back at this years from now, it's okay, was that completely over his head, or was it a sign of not what he's going to be? Because again, he's not going to be a 1,000 OPS guy,
right?
Who is, but is it a sign of, oh, okay, that he went off to a fast start and it was just a fast start in a very, very, very productive career. But we're going to wrap this up. I've got to go to a draft meeting, and I know, Ben, you've got more July 2 calls to make, but we do appreciate the download, and we're going to try to do this, the Ben and JJ show, on a hopefully relatively regular basis. Ben now has a quality mic of his own up in the Boston office of BA, and so we're pretty excited about that. So, Ben, you know, anything else that you want to touch on before we wrap this up?
No, I mean, it was good to, it's been an exciting rookie class. We should, I think we should get into that on the next podcast. I mean, obviously with, you know, Devin Travis, what he's doing with the, I mean, we could talk about all the guys on the Cubs.
Chris Bryant is posting Bonzian numbers without a home run yet. That's hard to do.
Jock Peterson, there's so many good rookies this year. And when you have guys like Correa and Seager and Buxton, who you have pretty much all the top prospects in the minor leagues right now who are doing so well. I mean, it's just so great to have.
Too.
Yeah, at the upper levels, it's just so great to have, especially Correa and Buxton hitting walk-off, double and home run in the same night. It's just so good to have those guys back and healthy. It's fun to see these guys who are going to, you know, potentially – keep that young talent pipeline coming up to the big leagues.
It is going to be fun to watch. But so for Ben Badler, I'm JJ Cooper. We thank you for a download here of the Prospect Handbook Podcast. We do want to also remind you, we got a lot of draft coverage coming up at baseballamerica.com. We also want to remind you all the books are now out. So if you go to baseballamerica.com/store, you can purchase any and all of the 2015 books. The most recent is we just got the Hall of Fame book back. So if you want the updated Hall of Fame book with all the new additions, you can get that now at baseballamerica.com/store. Thank you, everybody.